good evening. Trump jumps the pond and offers Boris Johnson a free trade deal if Brexit succeeds, and Con Ed feels the heat.
If I were you, I would be saying, I am so effing sorry for what happened.
And Google takes a $175 million hit for selling to kids without telling their parents. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Thursday, September 5th, 2019. Vice President Pence on Thursday met with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in London and discussed brokering a bilateral trade agreement between the United States and United Kingdom post-Brexit. Johnson said it would be fantastic to deepen economic ties between the two countries, but noted in typical Bojo style, the UK's National Health Service would not be up for sale as part of a bilateral trade deal. Pence offered support for Johnson's plan to exit the EU and described the relationship between the two countries as historic and special.
We believe a free trade agreement between the United States and the United Kingdom could increase trade between our two countries three or four times. And we're already going to work on that free trade agreement. When you're ready, we'll be ready. In fact, the President told me today to tell Prime Minister Johnson that when Brexit is complete, we will begin negotiations on a free trade agreement right away. Our message is clear. The minute the UK is out, America is in.
Their meeting came after Johnson endured a setback on Tuesday. He lost a vote on the exit plans when 21 members of his own party voted with other members of parliament to delay the withdrawal. Johnson, who is known for his comic routines, also took time to joke that the UK is not keen on that chlorinated chicken, referring to the American process of washing chicken in chemicals that is banned in the UK. Meanwhile, Hurricane Dorian raked the Carolina coast with howling, window-rattling winds and sideways rain Thursday, spinning off tornadoes and knocking out power to more than 200,000 homes and businesses as it pushed northward toward the dangerously exposed Outer Banks. The persistent hurricane left a path of devastation in the Bahamas, destroying homes and leaving a death toll of at least 20. As of midday, it was a Category 2, blowing at 110 miles per hour. The National Hurricane Center's projected track showed Dorian passing near or over North Carolina's Outer Banks early Friday, lashing the thin line of islands that stick out from the U.S. coast like a boxer's chin. Dorian was then expected to peel away from the shoreline. The National Hurricane Center forecast as much as 15 inches of rain for the coastal Carolinas, with flash flooding likely. Florida and Georgia, were about 2 million people had been warned to clear out, were mostly spared since Dorian stayed offshore. Dorian is another major storm whose peculiar behavior and intensity has been chalked up to climate change. More coastal hurricanes, slow-moving with tremendous rainfall, are expected in coming years. In New York City, climate change and the city's ability to meet the challenge were front and center before the Committee on Consumer Affairs of the New York City Council yesterday. Council members were looking into several power outages that swept the city this July when a heat wave gripped the city with temperatures soaring well over 100 degrees. New York City gets its power from Con Edison, which some say provides terrible service at a premium price. House Speaker Corey Johnson.
If I were you, I would be saying, I am so effing sorry for what happened. I am so, this is embarrassing. This is terrible. We know that there are people in nursing homes and on ventilators and people that don't have air conditioning and businesses that are losing money. And we are sorry. I don't hear that. There's not that enthusiasm or that exuberance or that passion in what's been said. Tim Cawley should be here today. I don't know why he's not here. He went yesterday. He should come here. I'm very disappointed he's not here. But anyone who's a public representative should be saying that. The governor is outraged and saying, what has he said about Con Ed, that you don't have a right to your license to operate in the state. You're hearing elected officials and the public over and over again talk about what happened. You had hundreds of people stuck in elevators across the city. Thousands of businesses affected. Tens of millions of dollars lost. And I don't hear that level of apology from Con Ed from the day it happened until today or yesterday with Tim Cawley. I don't know who does your PR. I don't know who does your communications. I don't know who details what you should say publicly or in testimony. But you need someone new to advise you on how to communicate with the public, because it is inadequate and laughable at this point.
And Tim Colley is president of Con Edison. That was Corey Johnson, speaker of the New York City Council. Public advocate Jumani Williams told about how his own family was affected by an outage in Brooklyn.
There was the blackout in Brooklyn. The first press release put out by Con Edison announced that the company was responding to multiple outages. 2.5 hours later at 11
blackout
p.m.
in Brooklyn.
The first press release put out by Con Edison announced that the company was responding to multiple outages. 2.5 hours later at 11 p.m., the second press release put out, the company stated that the blackout was an intentional, preemptive move to protect vital equipment. I am thankful that Con Ed allowed me to visit their Brooklyn Command Center and a few days later. When we asked about the conflicting nature of these statements, Con Edison seemed to be completely unaware of the conflict. There are $1 billion of profits. We're still asking where $695 million of infrastructure spending went to. In the hours leading to the outage, my office also found out that one of the feeders was offline for regular maintenance. As the temperature remained high and demand on the grid began to rise, voltage in the area was reduced to mitigate the impact of this increased demand. Soon, one of the feeder cables malfunctioned, shifting the burden to the remaining feeders and subsequently leading to a chain of failures. After the fourth failure, the Corporate Emergency Response Center, which includes Con Edison leadership, Public Service Commission, PSC representation, and the New York City Emergency Management Office was put on direct notice at the potential for the blackout shortly after a fifth and final feeder failed. My office was informed that after this moment, Con Edison leadership had approximately 5 minutes to make the call to depower the grid to prevent a power catastrophic outage. After that call was made, there was approximately, according to Con Edison staff, between 20 minutes and an hour and a half between when the call to de-energize the network was made and the blackout itself. These vital minutes could have been used to warn the public about what was going on, what was happening, especially vulnerable citizens like my aunt and uncle who spent the night, my aunts who spent the night putting ice packages as much as possible on my uncle who was bedridden. The fact that no outreach was made to even the most vulnerable members of the community, such as seniors and people with disabilities, is unconscionable and is a miracle that nobody was harmed, but I am thankful they were not. I have yet to get assurance that these catastrophic communications failures was a fluke. Moreover, I'm still concerned, I'm still unclear of its future communications plan if a similar incident were to happen again in New York City. I sincerely hope this hearing will help quell these concerns, as well as the concerns about what happened in New York City, particularly when there was money sent there to fix the issues that happened in the city blackout. In the coming days, I'll be working on legislation to improve communication transparency during the blackout and hold the company accountable. Again, I thank the council committees for hosting these hearings today. If Con Edison is unable to answer these questions, at some point we do have to figure if whether Con Edison is the one that should be running this. And I know there's discussion around whether it should be public. I know that takes a lot of time, so my hope is that the state just begins a process in case that's the direction we need to go in.
And that is public advocate Jumani Williams speaking about Con Ed. Corey Johnson, again, described the extent of the summer's electrical problems, which many people don't realize just how far and deep it went. And he expresses fear that Con Ed is not up to the task represented or presented by the climate change problems the city is facing.
Electricity is a daily necessity that we use to power our transportation, businesses, schools, medical facilities, and nearly every facet of daily life for New York City's 8.6 million people. When the power goes out in New York City, it not only causes severe economic hardship and tens of millions of dollars in losses, it can literally cost lives. And yet, New York City is regularly plagued by power outages, including several that occurred this summer, one of which coincided with a deadly heat wave. A power outage in this city translates to complete and utter chaos. It is unacceptable. It is unacceptable for adults and children alike to be trapped underground in subway cars or elevators in complete darkness. It is unacceptable for the city's multi-billion dollar economy, one of the largest economies in the world, to ground to a halt because of entirely preventable equipment failures. It is unacceptable for civilians to have to direct traffic because all the lights are out. It is unacceptable for residents and restaurants alike to throw out thousands and thousands of dollars worth of food. And it is completely unacceptable for the vulnerable among us to have their lives put at risk because they cannot turn on their air conditioning unit or leave their apartment. And yet, that is exactly what happened this summer.
And that's Corey Johnson. A study by the city says that there may be a tenfold increase in days over 100 degrees in New York alone. The temperatures will not decrease at night, and that heat waves may last much longer over the next few years due to climate change. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Count his role in supporting the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq as another part of Joe Biden's long political career that the former vice president, who voted for the war as a senator, doesn't quite remember correctly. In a recent interview, Biden told reporters that he's opposed the war from the very moment it began in March of 2003, despite voting for its authorization just months earlier. Biden said that he believed then-President George W. Bush's claim that Bush needed the threat of war to pressure Iraq to give up its weapons program and therefore voted for the authorization to use military force. But once Bush unleashed the shock and awe bombing campaign on the country, the former senator said he had a drastic change of heart. Well, Professor Stephen Zunis at the University of San Francisco, a professor of politics, had joined us live on the line. He says that in a recent article that Biden told basically lies about his position on Iraq. Welcome to WBAI, Professor Zunis.
Good to be on with you. Lies he said in the NPR interview a couple days ago was essentially the same he had given during the previous Democratic debate, claiming that opposed the war once it started. But the record shows very, very differently. He not only had he been calling for an invasion of Iraq since 1998, not only as senator, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he only allowed a day and a half worth of hearings and stacked the testimony rolls with proponents of the war. But when Bush announced the decision that meeting with senators that he was going to launch the invasion imminently, despite the return of UN inspectors and their failure to find in the so-called weapons of mass destruction, Biden said, unleash the dogs of war. We can negotiate. America will prevail. And in subsequent months, even when the Bush administration admitted there are no WMDs, Biden repeated that he made the right decision in supporting the war, and Bush made the right decision to invade.
Is Biden, the former vice president and a United States senator who voted for a war that he now claims he didn't support, is he basically moving quick with the facts in order to present himself as a different man than he actually was because we realize now in hindsight that the war was a terrible idea?
And that's the only way I can interpret it, frankly. He's not the only one. I mean, John Kerry and Hillary Clinton later gave the line that, we gave the president the authority to force the UN to get tough and get and force Saddam to bring back inspectors. But they like Biden, kept on supporting the war. Indeed, you'll notice that Biden and Clinton and Kerry were all co-sponsors of a resolution praising President Bush for the decision to invade. And so it was. This is definitely a rewriting of history. Besides, those of us who were around then knew darn well that passing the authorization of the use of military force was, in fact, an authorization for the use of military force. Pretty much everybody knew that if that version of the bill passed, it would give him, he'd use it as a blank check to go ahead and invade regardless of what inspectors found or didn't found or defined or anything like that. So this is really disingenuous for Biden to now insist that he actually opposed the invasion when he was so consistently in support of it before, during, and after.
So what could we think of Biden if he was to become president? How would he handle Kim Jong-un? How would he handle China? How would he handle Iran? These are all pressing issues of the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, Biden has traditionally been on the more hawkish wing of the Democratic Party, though, and though, he was in the Obama administration, he was often seen as more moderate than, say, Hillary Clinton and Bill Gates and some of the other people in the president's cabinet. It's hard to say. I mean, he'd like to think that he might have learned his lesson, but at the same time, anyone who would give Bush and Cheney a blank check to illegally invade a country on the far side of the world that was no threat to us, you have to wonder if, as president, he wouldn't ask Congress to give him the same authority he so eagerly granted Bush Cheney.
So you feel that he still has a lot of support. He's leading in the polls. People seem to be giving him a lot of, they're giving him on the Democratic side anyway. People are looking to him as the man who could beat Trump. Do you think that's go ahead.
And I think a lot of high poll numbers are most familiarity. He's by far the best known of the candidates running. But more fundamentally, I think there's a degree of nostalgia for the Obama era, which, despite the disappointments of many progressive Democrats, is looking absolutely amazingly wonderful compared to what we've had to put up under Trump. But I think as these issues come as Biden's role in the Iraq War and other controversial foreign and domestic policy positions he's taken get more attention, you'll see the support wane. We already have seen his support wane. Uh-huh. And I'm only hoping that Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and some of the more progressive Democrats that are running will compound on this thing about Iraq. Because, I'm not a single-issue kind of guy, but when you support something as predictably as disastrous as Iraq, and as WBAI listeners know, there were plenty of us back then talking about predicted exactly what was going to happen, including not finding WMDs. I mean, anybody who could blow a call that significant, it's not just about Iraq. It's about the UN Charter. It's about the Nuremberg Principles. It's about common sense. It's about budget priorities. I mean, go down the list. I really do think that this is an issue that if the more it's brought to the public, the less and less appealing Biden will be. I think that's why he's so desperate to cover up his actual record on it.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Stephen Zunis. Where can we read your article?
This is in the in Truth Out, truthout.org.
All right, truthout.org, that Biden cannot be trusted. Thank you very much, Professor Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, for joining us on WBAI. And you're listening to the news on WBAI. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And finally, in technology news, a coalition of activist groups representing more than 15 million combined members is pushing for a federal ban on law enforcement's use of facial recognition technology. The groups, which are planning to blanket lawmakers with emails and phone calls, are coming together under Ban Facial Recognition, which is organized by the digital rights group Fight for the Future, as a way to show the public exactly where and how the controversial surveillance technology is being used nationwide. Evan Greer is deputy director of Fight for the Future.
Facial recognition is spreading like an epidemic, both in the corporate sphere as well as use by law enforcement and government agencies in the United States and around the world. But fortunately, resistance and opposition to the use of facial recognition is also dramatically growing. We're seeing increasing bipartisan support in Congress to rein in law enforcement use of this technology. And just today, more than 30 organizations endorsed our BanFacialRecognition.com campaign, calling for that same goal of banning law enforcement and agencies like ICE and Border Patrol from using this type of invasive surveillance technology that strips people of their basic rights and has profound implications for basic freedom of expression and civil liberties.
What is facial recognition software, and what does it do? How does it work?
Facial recognition is a type of biometric surveillance. It essentially uses a computer to do something that law enforcement has done for a long time, which is to essentially compare a photograph or live video footage against a database. But what's so concerning about it is the way that it enables automated surveillance. So, you know, this isn't just looking at one person who may have committed a crime. This enables governments or corporations to essentially monitor everyone all the time and compare that information against the database. It also, as companies are improving these, you know, quote unquote, improving the software, they're claiming to be able to detect things like emotions. So you could have an algorithm that essentially says that person looks nervous or afraid. They should be subjected to additional screening, or that person looks hungry. You should serve them an advertisement for food. These are the types of things that corporations and law enforcement agencies are attempting to do with facial recognition. And all of them, again, have serious implications for our basic rights.
And why is this a problem? I mean, I know you generally say it's a violation of our rights and all those things, but how can it be actually used? How has it been used in a way that could be detrimental to people's rights?
Sure. So facial recognition is already being used by police departments in several cities, including Detroit. And one of the ways that it's so concerning is that these algorithms currently exhibit significant racial bias. So facial recognition surveillance systems are much more likely to misidentify people of color, women, people with darker skin, as criminals than white people, and particularly white men. And what that leads to is exacerbating existing forms of discrimination and racial profiling within our criminal justice system. When this, you know, software makes mistakes, when facial recognition software makes a mistake, that could land an innocent person in prison, or even get an innocent person shot by the police in a split-second moment when a facial recognition algorithm tells a law enforcement agent that this person is a criminal when, in fact, they're not. So there's really significant implications for this, and we've also seen it used in authoritarian regimes. China has used this technology to track, monitor, and marginalize minority Muslim population there. We've seen it used to crack down on political protests and dissidents in places like the UK. It's essentially an authoritarian government's perfect technology that enables not public safety, but social control.
Do you have any specific cases? Can you tell us about a specific case or two of where this has happened?
The big example is the ongoing use of this technology to track Muslims in China. But, you know, we're also seeing it, again, used with Project Greenlight, which is surveillance cameras that have been installed in private businesses across Detroit. It's been used to target people for arrest there. We've seen it being used in the United Kingdom, where a person was arrested simply for covering their face when walking past a facial recognition trial. It's also been used to target protesters. We saw an example in China where a person was pulled out of a crowd at a music festival and arrested using a facial recognition system. We're also seeing the spread of this being used commercially. Several commercial airlines have started to implement facial recognition systems for boarding. They're kind of marketing this as a form of convenience, saying, oh, you know, you don't need to even remember your boarding pass. We'll just scan your face before you get on the plane. This has significant implications. There's no real regulation or oversight for what they can do with that information once they've scanned your face and entered it into a database. And again, that creates significant implications for people's privacy. It allows that information to be shared with other law enforcement agencies or even with other corporations to use it for all kinds of purposes, from advertising to targeted surveillance.
Where do we go from here? What do you expect to achieve by this campaign?
We're seeing, again, a growing backlash to this spread of facial recognition at the local, state, and federal level. So several cities have already taken action to ban this type of technology, including San Francisco and Oakland and Somerville, Massachusetts. A handful of other cities have already gotten started on local ordinances. State-level legislation has been introduced in Michigan, Massachusetts, and California. So there's really growing momentum at the local level. But really, in the end, this is something that Congress should address. Our elected officials in Congress absolutely have the authority to put limitations on what types of technology law enforcement should be using. And really, facial recognition belongs on a very short list of technology like nuclear or biological weapons, where the potential harm that it poses to human society is so great that it outweighs any potential benefits. And that's why we're calling for an outright federal ban on law enforcement use of facial recognition surveillance.
What happens if you block? Are there laws that say it's against the law to block facial recognition technology? For example, if you put a plastic, even though it's visible, your license plate, if you put something that defeats the license plate cameras, you can be, you know, getting a lot of trouble for that. Are there laws in the United States anyway that say if you do anything, because I see people have these technologies they're coming up with to help block the facial cameras. Is there any laws that say yet that are being proposed that say it's illegal to block them from being able to see your face?
Not that I've seen so far, although you can kind of imagine how this plays out, right? And this is something that commercial airlines have been saying is, oh, you know, our facial recognition system is opt-out, so people can tell us if they don't want to participate in it. But you can imagine how that actually works at the airport. You show up in the line, you say, no, I don't want to do facial recognition. That immediately casts suspicion on you and may subject you to additional screening or surveillance. And, you know, the same is true, you know, if you're walking down the street wearing, you know, some kind of mask or something to disrupt facial recognition. The reality is this is not something that people should have to fix with gimmicks or masks or technology themselves. This is an issue that should be addressed with policy. And that's why we need our elected officials to protect our basic rights and ban this type of invasive surveillance.
Evan Greer, Deputy Director of Fight for the Future. The technology has been banned by three cities, Oakland and San Francisco in California and Somerville, Massachusetts, and at least one 2020 presidential candidate, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, has called for a ban on its use by law enforcement. Two tests of Amazon's facial recognition software, which the tech giant claims can now detect fear, falsely labeled California state lawmakers and members of Congress as criminal suspects. Most of the false positives were people of color in both tests. And that's some of the news for Thursday, September 5th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.